The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. That program being Indie Week, the independent weekly journal, read by John Federson today in the new year, January the 8th of 2026. We'll begin today with an article from Cary about the resignation of their town manager suddenly. Cary Mayer reflects on this resignation. 2 months ago, Sean Stiegel was the successful, seemingly uncontroversial town manager of Cary, a low-profile but influential position that gave him control of a 1,300-person staff and a $500 million annual budget to work with. Stiegel was nearing his 10-year work anniversary and had just published a book chronicling his accomplishments and leadership philosophy. By all accounts, he deserved as much credit as anyone for making Cary a prosperous, well-run town. Then, on November 20, the Cary Town Council placed Stiegel on administrative leave after learning he had engaged in excessive spending without council approval. In the following weeks, public records requests and reporting revealed that Stiegel had unilaterally signed off on land purchases totaling over $1 million, approved the town's payment of council members' tuition, and violated the town's fund balance policy, all without informing the full town council. A few weeks later, Stiegel resigned. In an emergency town council meeting, Mayor Harold Weinbrech said Stiegel had misled council members and created a, quote, unhealthy work environment. The town hired Womble Bond Dickinson, a law firm that specializes in employment investigations, to conduct a full probe of Stiegel's activity. The state auditor's office announced its own investigation. To Weinbrech, the revelations were both painful and galvanizing. Indy sat down with the mayor at Cary's town hall this week to talk about the events leading up to the resignation and how the town is responding in the aftermath. Here are some takeaways from this conversation. Weinbrech, who has served as mayor since 2007 and helped hire Stiegel in 2016, says he felt blindsided when his former town manager's misconduct came to light. He said, "When I first started hearing things, I remember going home and staring at the TV with it being off for hours, going, 'What is going on? How did I get here? What happened? Why did he do that? He's my friend. I thought he was my friend. How did I not see that?' I don't have answers to those questions. I just don't know what happened." Weinbrech says he first noticed changes in Stiegel's behavior a few months ago when the former manager began canceling their weekly one-on-one meetings. "In hindsight, those cancellations are glaring red flags," the mayor says, but, quote, "I didn't question anything at the time because I believed in him and trusted him." Weinbrech says he doesn't know what made the former town manager act the way he did and said he wishes him well at his best. Weinbrech said Stiegel was brilliant at his job, but, quote, "he was manipulating a lot of people and a lot of things at the same time, which would take a lot of brilliance to do that as well, including coming across as your best friend, one of your best friends, and makes you feel like a fool." During his decade as manager, Stiegel changed a lot about Cary's government structure. He dissolved and created departments, shuffled staff around them, and implemented new programs. He oversaw the rollout of the 311 service and the opening of downtown Cary Park. When Indy asked Weinbrech how he weighs Stiegel's accomplishments against his spending and conduct, the mayor said it's complicated, but overall, he believes Cary, quote, "went in a great direction for those years." The dual Womble, Bond Dickinson, and state auditor investigations will reveal more details about the spending and conduct in time, says the mayor right now. He says he wishes he hadn't let Stegall brush off multiple requests by the council to conduct a staff survey to assess employee satisfaction. And Weinberg said, looking back, that's one of the things we should have said. No, 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 we insist on it. We need it now. And it never happened. That would have given us a clue of the energy. Is it really going in a positive direction? De Meyer also has questions about why taxes rose so much for Cary residents in 2024, even though he knows inflation, flattening revenues, and county-level revaluations played a role. He wonders if there was, quote, a better way to get to that point that would have been less jarring for residents. I do question the finances in the past, he says. I'm glad we're having an internal investigation to see if anything was done inappropriately. When the council announced Stegall's resignation in December, Weinberg said the former town manager had created, quote, an unhealthy work environment. This week, the mayor explained that he learned about the workplace issues from staff members who sent him anonymous tips. From there, the council interviewed some staff members about Stegall's behavior. From those interviews, Weinberg says he learned Stegall, quote, was unpredictable. He was doing things, saying things to certain staff members that were inappropriate, and they felt like he was not being the leader he once was. He says he can't go into any more detail about this behavior, except to say people weren't treated professionally. Weinberg says the staff who reported on Stegall were heroes, in my opinion, to risk their jobs, careers, because they believed in the town and the organization enough to come to the council and tell us what they knew. And it was upsetting for us, upsetting for them. It was one of the lowest points I've seen in my 22-plus years as an elected official, to sit through that. Out of the 7 town council members, 2, Bella Huang and Brittany Richards, were just sworn in last month. 2 more, Sarika Bansal and Michelle Craig, have only served about 2 years. Most of the council, other than Weinbrecht and Mayor Pro Tem Laurie Bush, have only ever worked with Stegall as town manager. Weinbrecht says having a new council with very little experience creates trust issues between council and town staff, council and public, and amongst the members themselves. He said new council members are very influenced by what is around them, and they don't have a lot of big-picture information. They might rely on other council members, which in itself poses a danger. We have to, as a council and a staff, make sure that newer members are educated so they can make the decisions based on the big picture. He adds that the council is not aligned about how to move forward. And he said, I talked with one council member at length this weekend and it didn't end well. That person thinks, what's wrong with meeting in private and coming up with solutions, then presenting it to the council? I'm like, well, information is power, and power can break trust. They didn't agree with that. That's not the way we've done it. Well, the way we've done the last 2 years isn't correct, so we went back and forth on that. I didn't get anywhere. Weinberg says the council members disagree about how quickly they should announce all the reforms Cary will implement. He's in the camp that doesn't want to rush to solutions that might be overcorrections in the heat of the moment, but he noted the town recently moved to televise all council meetings and recently created a public portal to track all records requests, 2 measures that should increase transparency. Here's what to expect from Cary in the months to come. Weinberg wants to make the annual budget process more transparent this year in order to reassure taxpayers that the town is spending their money wisely. That means slowing the process down and getting the public involved. He says, budgets are all about values, and so if the public's value is that we should be cutting things, that's probably a good direction. Weinberg says he does not want to make cuts to police, fire, or public works, which he says are 80% of what we do, and the best of the best, but that's a discussion we want to have with the public. In addition, to recording all public meetings of the town council, Kerry has eliminated one-on-one meetings between the town manager and individual council members. The manager serving in an interim capacity is Russ Overton. Instead, the town is holding 3x4 meetings between 3 council and 4 staff, including the manager and the mayor. This way, Weinberg says, everyone gets the same information and meetings are documented properly. Because of the strength of this organization, one bad player did not impact the organization as greatly as they could have, and that's because of the incredible staff, says Weinberg. I think that we will come out stronger because of this, because we have stronger policies, stronger procedures, and we'll know what we need to do as an organization to move forward. To Wake County generally, a long-term plan to ensure water sustainability for all of Wake County nears completion. A 50-year plan to safeguard access to clean and abundant water for residents is nearing completion after 3 years in development. The Wake County One Water Plan is designed, quote, to protect the water supply, reduce nutrient pollution, mitigate flooding, and promote equal access to these benefits, according to the draft dated to September 10th of last year. It is a collaboration between Wake County's 12 municipalities to ensure there will be enough clean water as the county grows. The county anticipates its population will grow by 250,000 people over the next decade. That's a quarter of a million, folks. And is preparing to add more than 2 million residents by 2070. The county also projects water demand will more than double within its municipal water supply system by 2070, based on the levels in 2021. Leaders anticipate taking this One Water Plan to the Wake County Board of Commissioners next month. Nancy Daly, the Water Resource Program Manager for Wake County, said the plan is designed to proactively meet predicted needs for residents, as well as business, agriculture, natural resource, and recreation. Daly said the plan recognizes that it's all connected, right? Surface water is connected to groundwater and wastewater, and it doesn't care about jurisdictional boundaries. So when we think about water, we really need to think in collaboration and partnership at a regional level, because we live upstream and downstream from our neighbors. The draft plan outlines water supply, wastewater treatment, stormwater and flood management, and groundwater protection as its area of focus. Daly said every water utility in the county will have to expand to meet future needs incurred by growth and development, as well as predicted higher temperatures, more droughts, and worse flooding. The draft also calls for reorganizing and aligning the County Water Guidance Group, Wake County Water Partnership, increasing education and outreach, developing the workforce, and updating policies, ordinances, and regulations. The plan identifies areas like creating a flood gauge database, creating a countywide stormwater reuse master plan, and expanding the existing monitoring well network as items that could receive funding. The plan also addresses data centers. Now, a data storage facility is proposed for a parcel of land near Apex, which the town's Environmental Advisory Board approved conditions for last October. Data centers require large amounts of energy and sometimes water to run and cool their systems. Although it is possible, the eventual user for Apex data center will operate with air or fluid cooling systems. It could also use between 500,000 and 1.5 million gallons per day of non-potable treated wastewater from a nearby treatment facility. Daly said about that. We just want to make sure we are well-informed and prepared should that demand come in. Now, public comment on this plan concluded last October after more than 3 years of conversations with public officials and local residents. The Wake County One Water Team, which includes county staff, engineering consultant Tetra Tech, water quality and supply consultant Hazen and Sawyer, and RTI International, drafted the plan. One Wake County town, Fuquay Varina, has already taken steps to address an anticipated water shortage. The town is seeking state approval of a plan that would allow it to pull water from the Cape Fear River Basin in Lee County and discharge the treated wastewater into the Neuse Basin in Wake County. That plan, which has faced opposition from stakeholders in eastern North Carolina, attempts to address an anticipated shortfall in water supplies by 2030 because of rapid population growth and increased development. Daly said Fuquay Varina is an active member of the Triangle Water Supply Partnership, which has been part of One Water's plans development, saying, I would say this is a perfect example of how we need to be thinking regionally and how we use our water. While we're going to need to continue to have expanded water resources to meet these needs, we do have a limited amount. And so we've got to think about upstream, downstream users with any decisions that we make. A spokesperson for the town of Fuquay Varina did not respond to Indy's request for an interview before our deadline. In Wake County, 85% of the population depends on water from surface reservoirs like Falls Lake or Jordan Lake. The other 15% depends on groundwater from private or community wells, Daly said. With Durham and Orange counties also drawing from these sources, Daly said a 50-year plan is needed to address the anticipated growth of these counties. Daly said, we need the community, we need the public, we need everybody to be all hands on deck and have a place at the table, thinking about conservation, about best practices we can do in our yards to help conserve water and plant native species. There's so many different strategies and roles that we can all play that it's going to take all of us working together to really make sure we can achieve our goals. Back to Kerry for an interesting story. From a retirement community to a 5,000-person protest, this Kerry activist group is growing. A giant blue axolotl dancing to cheers, laughter, and honking horns. That was the vibe at Kerry Indivisible's No Kings protest in October, a gathering of some 5,000 people united against President Donald Trump's authoritarian agenda. The local activist group was founded back in February by longtime Democrats Steve and Martha Glass. The group's first meeting was limited to about 30 people living in the Glass's retirement community, Glen Eyre. But word soon spread. Now, Kerry Indivisible has expanded beyond Glen Eyre to include some 700 official members, mostly, quote, younger seniors and middle-aged Kerry residents, with even more people of all ages coming to protests. The group held 6 protests throughout the spring and summer, including No Kings 1 in June, which drew more than 2,500 to the corner of Maynard and Kildare Farm Roads. No Kings 2 on October 18th was Kerry's largest to date. A fellow came to me about 2 weeks before No Kings 2, recalled Steve. He said, I'm registered for your protest, but I don't know what to do. And I said, well, just have fun. Shout, bring a sign, and have fun. By that measure, Kerry Indivisible has been overwhelmingly successful in a world where fear, anger, and hatred feel like they're lurking around every corner, ready to leap up and overtake any conversation given the right excuse. These protesters are putting out joy. As Steve says, they're having a lot of fun making fools of themselves. Of course, there is a serious agenda behind the inflatable costumes and rainbow peace signs. Carrie Indivisible is a microcosm of a larger nationwide movement dedicated to preserving democracy and resisting right-wing politics. In practice, that means raising money for immigration lawyers, calling members of Congress, and canvassing neighborhoods ahead of elections. Many Carrie Indivisible members are vehemently against ICE, I-C-E, and the elimination of DEI programs, and enthusiastically for Medicaid and universal health care. However, the uniting sentiment is of power to the people. Protesters at Carrie Indivisible events hold signs that read, "Stop Truth Decay," and "Due Process is Hot." In October, one hastily written poster board sign said, "When tyranny becomes law, rebellion becomes duty." Another questioned passersby, asking, "If you're not anti-fascist, what are you?" The rapid growth of Carrie Indivisible is reflected in cities across the United States where "No Kings" has become a rallying cry, a touchstone, and a slogan, seen on bumper stickers, pins, and T-shirts. It also coincides with big Democratic wins in Cary, where Democrats defeated Republicans in all three city council races on balance this fall. Ballots. Every seat in the council is now filled by a Democrat. Steve and Martha Glass are not new to political engagement. Steve was the man in charge of Jim Hunt's first successful campaign for governor in 1977. After that, he stayed on as the executive director of the North Carolina Democratic Party. Meanwhile, Martha was working as Hunt's executive secretary and later as a legislative liaison in the Department of Administration. In the early 2000s, she led the development of the state's agrotourism industry in the Department of Agriculture. Both have years of experience in grassroots political organizing, skills that have enabled them to create a safe, well-organized, and sustainable activist group. The couple regularly send out email newsletters, connect members with training opportunities, and survey people about what they'd like to do next. Crucially, there's also something incredibly compelling about the way they talk politics, blunt, with no prevarication. Steve, who retired from the U.S. Navy as a two-star admiral, openly called Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth an idiot, speculating about his impeachment. As he discussed the toxic political environment, he half-joked about being deported or snatched off the street for speaking against Republicans. "Until recently," Steve said, "the Democratic Party has acted as if everything was business as usual. Frustration with the political establishment was one factor that led him and Martha to start Carrie Indivisible. While the Republican Party has been incredibly active, marshaling support for Project 2025 and driving the rise of MAGA and white nationalism, the Democratic Party has been sluggish and unorganized," Steve argued. "The day after Trump won on November 5th last year, people started coming to us saying, 'What do we do? What can we do? This is awful.' That first meeting," added Martha, "every single person in that room began to vent one at a time. It took us an extra hour just to let everyone say what was on their mind, what they wanted to do, what they were afraid of, what they were hoping for. That pain and worry and fear people were feeling became the emotional catalyst for the movement. People came to Carrie Indivisible in search of community empowerment. And while Steve and Martha have also felt worried, afraid, and even burned out by the cascade of terrible news coming from the administration, there is a new feeling growing with every event they organize. Hope. We know we're doing the right thing," Martha said. "We're trying to save our country." This broadcast of Indie Week is sort of scooting about the state, or the Wake County anyway. And this next article comes from Raleigh, kind of. With the recent purchase of the former Wayne Correctional Center down in Goldsboro, Kerwin Pittman is laying claim to an unusual title. He says he's the first formerly incarcerated person in the United States to purchase a prison. Pittman is the founder and executive director of Recidivism Reduction Educational Program Services, Incorporated, or REPS, REPS. He was sent to prison at age 18 and served 11 and a half years for conspiracy to commit murder. January 26th will mark 8 years since his release and return to the Southeast Raleigh community in which he was reared. Pittman said, "I started a nonprofit when I came home and began advocating for individuals coming out of the system, but I also put in programming to try to help them reintegrate into society with a little more ease." His experience behind bars gave him insight into what other formerly incarcerated individuals needed after they left prison. He said, "I had family support, so I had housing. But a lot of my friends didn't have any place to go, or if they did, there was a time limit on how long they could stay." His purchase of an abandoned 400-bed prison is an extension of the work he started soon after he left prison. He plans to create reentry housing and a workforce campus where formerly incarcerated people can attain job skills or industry certifications. Pittman said, "The campus would be like a stabilization phase for guys coming out of jail or prison to give them a six-month pause so they can get their life back on track." Pittman estimates it'll take up to 2 years to get this former prison ready for as many as 300 residents who would live on the campus until they completed the six-month-long program. Another class of up to 300 would replace the previous residents every 6 months, he said. He envisions residents studying and training to become electricians, plumbers, HVAC techs, construction workers, and other trades that are in high demand. And he said, right now, not only in the United States, but particularly in North Carolina, and particularly rural North Carolina, they are experiencing a decline in people seeking trade jobs. Other residents might choose a track to earn industry certifications or a commercial driver's license, he said. The program will be open to previously incarcerated individuals from across the state. We'll take referrals, he said. We'll have a case management team that go inside the jails and prison. Then we'll go see if the candidate is the best fit for our program. Pittman said it would make sense to locate such a facility in Goldsboro, even if the former prison wasn't available. He said Goldsboro is suffering right now with the plague of not only violence, but also poverty. It only made sense when this came up for sale to purchase it because of all the other things that are going on in eastern North Carolina, but also in that area. He said he bought the former prison for under $1 million and projects it will take about $2 million to refurbish it while taking care to ensure it no longer looks like a prison. Pittman will rely heavily on private donations to fund this enterprise, but has not ruled out pursuing local, state, or federal funding. That prison closed in 2013 as North Carolina sought to save money by reducing prison capacity after inmate populations declined. Wayne County Commissioner Bevan Foster had not heard about the project, but was excited after a reporter shared the news. Foster said if he's able to do what he said he's going to do, it'd be great. It's the kind of program we need. He noted the irony of the prison being repurposed. They're using it for some good, Foster said. It would be a great thing. Wayne County Commissioner Antonio Williams also had not heard about the proposal, but said it would be a wonderful opportunity for people leaving prison, saying, "You can look around and see a lot of people who have been rehabilitated, but they come home and it's challenging for them to even have housing, challenging for them to find a job." Many formerly incarcerated individuals return home to find that relatives or loved ones have died or they've just lost those relationships while they were away, and they don't have any place to go, said Williams. Pittman's proposal, he said, would definitely give them a chance to rejoin life and get the basic steps in order, like finding jobs, housing, and health care, all of those things that are valuable and have meaning. As the NC Newsline previously reported a year ago, Pittman launched the state's first mobile reentry service center to bring resources and support to people reentering society from prison. He followed up with a second mobile center 6 months later. The centers provide previously incarcerated people with case management and other services like job placement, housing assistance, mental health support, and help obtaining important documents such as identification. Finally, Pittman said the time he spent behind bars fuels his passion to help others. Quote, "Me going into the system young, getting in trouble, and being to come out on the other side of that, and to be honest, just following my spirit and God leading the way, it made me want to help, to be able to help other people." Next, an article from Durham I've been unable to read because the station has not been on for a couple of weeks, at least when I record my indie weeks. A beloved Durham lesbian nightlife institution turns 10. This came out on New Year's Eve. Erin Karcher, owner of a popular lesbian bar, Arcana Bar and Lounge in downtown Durham, laughs, "The terror has calmed down now at year 10, but it felt super risky to open a bar at the time, and it was terrifying until we had already been open for a year." Karcher opened Arcana with a former business partner, Lindsay Andrews, in December of 2015 after Andrews approached Karcher one summer night with the idea of opening their own bar. It would be a tarot card cocktail bar, a space unlike any other in Durham. Karcher said of their initial vision, "Lindsay and I definitely wanted to have a bar that was queer inclusive and LGBTQT friendly, and particularly a place that felt safe and welcoming to women." The pair had plenty of hospitality experience between them, but neither had run a business before. Still, they had confidence that the bar would succeed, leaning heavily on Google and other friends in the industry to figure things out. A decade later, it's safe to say they've figured things out. If you've been to Arcana, you know it's a bit tricky to find. The bar is located in the Snow Building downtown, but you'll need to walk through an alley and down a flight of stairs to get there. The somewhat hidden entrance gives Arcana speakeasy-esque vibes and just adds to the bar's allure. Those charming vibes have come a long way, though. Karcher said, "It was pretty much the only thing we could afford," explaining that the space's ugly gray carpet and blinking fluorescent lights had made it unappealing to other prospective tenants. The two got to work revamping that basement bar to make it look like what you'll find today, an inviting, welcoming, and cozy waterhole and gathering place that's become a staple in the LGBTQT community in Durham. From the beginning, Arcana has been known for its wide range of events. Karcher said some might recall their early super-secret dance parties that turned the space into an underground oasis for all the Durham nightlife hounds who prefer sweaty cellars and warehouses to spacious rooms with bottle service, before that pandemic brought that tradition to a halt. Dance parties aside, you'll still find something on the calendar every night these days: tarot readings, burlesque and comedy shows, queer Dungeons and Dragons playing nights, DJ sets, a queer craft night. Karcher said, "I don't actually want to run a business whose primary goal is to serve people alcohol and get them intoxicated." While she acknowledges that getting people to drink, whether it's something alcoholic or something from their extensive non-alcoholic menu, is how the bar makes money, she says it's the programming that really draws people in and makes Arcana stand out from all other bars in Durham. "I don't think that we could have survived without our programming, she says. In 23, Karcher became sole owner of Arcana when Andrews left to start Night School Bar, a similarly unorthodox bar space. While Arcana had always been known around town as an inclusive and queer-friendly bar, Karcher's employees pushed her to lean into the identity more. Karcher said, "My youngest employee, Meg, asked, 'Can we be gayer now?' And I was like, 'Yeah, let's do that.'" The bar launched one of its most popular events called Dyke Night soon after, a mix-and-mingle-type themed event each month to embrace its identity. But Karcher wanted more. She applied to be an official lesbian bar through the Lesbian Bar Project. In early 24, Arcana became the 32nd recognized lesbian bar in the country and remained the only bar of its kind in North Carolina. Karcher said, "It really matters that we're on the lesbian bar list. It really kind of makes the whole state seem a bit safer and queerer, and it's part of a contributing force that helps Durham indicate that Durham is definitely a little bit of a safe pocket." Arcana officially celebrated its 10th birthday earlier in December and shows no sign of slowing down as it enters its next decade. The plans for the future? "I want to deepen our involvement in the community and maintain a safe spot where people feel safe and free." Well, with 20 minutes left in this broadcast of Indie Week, I've chosen a longer article that was first put in on the 5th of January, and it's titled "On the Hunt for North Carolina's Biggest Trees." I might add, by the way, before I begin this, that it's copiously full of photographs and illustrations about some of the trees mentioned. And those who have the ability and interest to look at that can, as with all these articles, visit indieweek.com and find these articles. In fact, the whole issues are free for downloading and viewing and listening. And listening, of course, if you come here. But here's the article itself. Okay, and here we go. More than 24 species of oak are native to North Carolina. But with a quick glance and some context, Luke Ferreira and Spencer Kane can identify pretty much all of them, not to mention most trees in every other native genus as well. On a John boat cutting up Turkey Quarter Creek in the eastern part of the state, Ferreira has been instructing me about the differences between water oaks and laurel oaks, writes Jonathan Pattishall, the author. He says, "Water oaks have a leaf shaped like a teardrop, and laurel oaks have an almost diamond-shaped leaf. And believe it or not, laurel oaks like water more than water oaks do." Ferreira takes his trees seriously, but he also allows himself a moment of amusement at the water oak's ironic name, and it's right back to swamp ecology. Water oaks still like water, they just don't necessarily like standing water. Turkey Quarter Island, which lies between the creek on one side and the Neuse River on the other, is flooded from a nor'easter that had recently passed over Craven County, home to nearby Vanceboro. There's water almost everywhere. That's okay, though. The specific tree we're looking for right now doesn't mind getting its roots wet. It thrives in the swamp. It's grown so big out here, it has earned itself a title. Kane says, "When we found this one, it was in the most perfect health we've seen." He and Ferreira are hoping the tree's good health helped it through the storm. Big trees are generally big because they've been growing a long time. In other words, because they're old, and like many older things, old trees are liable to blow over in a nor'easter. It's not guaranteed we'll find this one upright. But as Ferreira throttles the motor and we glide around a bend in the creek, an enormous mass emerges from the subtropical thicket and immediately commands our view. There it is, the largest known water hickory in North Carolina. "I'll be danged," Kane says with relief. "Look at that. Still standing," confirms Ferreira. The pair began hunting for champion trees 5 years ago. This uncommon hobby takes them deep into the woods to look for the biggest trees they can find in any given species, both the biggest of the big and the biggest of the small. Though they keep their eyes open for superlative trees everywhere they go, they hunt for them predominantly in central and eastern North Carolina. Their big finds reflect the tree species native to those regions. The North Carolina Forest Service, which is part of the State Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, maintains a list of the largest known tree for each species in the state, and the University of Tennessee maintains the National Register of Champion Trees for the biggest ones in the country. Ferreira and Kane seek out giant trees mostly for fun, but if they discover a clear contender, they'll nominate it to the relevant organization to see if they found a new state or national champion. Such was the case 2 years ago. When they first came across this particular water hickory, they thought it must be bigger than the current state champion, so they measured it and sent their numbers to the North Carolina Forest Service, along with the coordinates. In keeping with its protocols, the agency sent out a county ranger who checked their measurements and confirmed their tree was indeed larger than the previous champion. Ferreira and Kane haven't seen the hickory since it was crowned champ and added to the state list, so they wanted to drop in on a wellness check. "We'll throw a tape measure on it, see if it's grown any," says Ferreira. While they work, they talk me through the mechanics of measuring trees. Even within the same species, trees can vary so widely in their dimensions, it's not always clear how to evaluate differences in size. Over the years, foresters and tree hunters have developed a more or less standardized approach for these comparisons, which is used today by both the National Champion Program and the Forest Service in the state. Trees are given scores on three criteria: 1 point for each inch of trunk circumference, and 1/4 point for each foot of average crown spread, both measured with a simple tape measure, as well as 1 point for each foot of height, measured with a laser rangefinder or a clinometer. When tallied, these points allow for comparisons between different tree shapes. It takes Ferreira and Kane working together to string the tape measure around the behemoth water hickory. When they reconnect the ends of the tape, it reads 216 inches, or 18 feet on the dot. Ferreira says it's gained 6 inches in circumference, so it's still growing pretty vigorously. When something reaches the end of its life, its growth slows way down, almost to the point of not growing at all. 6 inches in 2 years is promising. Standing at the hickory's base and looking up, I am awestruck by its presence. Its topmost twigs and leaves reach out high above the forest canopy, and its larger branches don't even begin emerging from the trunk until 40 or 50 feet above the ground. To think this tree is still growing vigorously is inspiring and almost unbelievable. As we trudge through the semi-aquatic underbrush at our next stop, Ferreira tells me, "We keep this as a hobby. We don't want it to feel like a job." We're searching now for an overcup oak, a particularly stout one that Ferreira and Kane know they've seen out here somewhere. They haven't had a chance to measure it before, but they think it might give the current state champion overcup oak a run for its acorns. I know what Ferreira means about hobbies and jobs, but I still find his statement a little curious. Both men work in the Raleigh office of Bartlett Tree Experts, one of America's largest tree care companies. Ferreira is a safety coordinator, Kane a sales representative. Both are certified arborists. Working with trees is their job. They became fast friends at Bartlett. After Kane discovered the North Carolina Big Tree list online, he and Ferreira realized their specialized knowledge would give them an advantage when looking for champions. In the woods, they are literally hugging trees to get the tape measure around massive trunks. But neither is anything like popular ideas about a metaphorical tree hugger. A country boy who grew up in New Bern, Ferreira, 26, tells me with his easy southern drawl about all the different hunting seasons, actual animal hunting, not tree hunting, that he enjoys. Deer, bear, rabbits, squirrels, ducks, doves, pretty much anything, he says. His favorite place to get barbecue is Skylight Inn at Aden, the mark of a true eastern North Carolinian. Kane, 29, is an Army veteran from Apex. He joined Bartlett after spending 4 years as a paratrooper and 50-caliber machine gunner with the 82nd Airborne over at Fort Bragg. He's more reserved than Ferreira, but he opens up to direct questions. When I asked him about his Army service, he said, "Feels like 5 decades ago. I forgot I was in a lot. Just like, oh yeah, I did that, right." I'll have to pause this just a second. Okay. Though they still get out on tree hunting excursions when they can, the frequency dropped about 3 years ago when both became fathers within 6 months of each other. Ferreira and his girlfriend had their daughter first. Kane and his fiancée welcomed a baby girl shortly thereafter. Before I can ask them more about fatherhood, something interesting catches Ferreira's eye. "Oh, I thought that was a Carolina ash," he says, inspecting the leaves and bark on a slender tree more closely. "That would have been a huge one." Turns out it's just a relatively small green ash, but the mix-up reveals one of the quirks of champion tree hunting. Two trees of the same size that look identical to the untrained eye might actually be different species, making one a runaway champion and the other a middling wannabe. Ferreira and Kane's dendrological expertise gives them a leg up, both in tree hunting and in the outdoors more generally. They see and appreciate things in the woods that most people take for granted or miss entirely. The mere presence of the green ash here also transmits some meaningful information. Ferreira says, "I don't know if you've heard of the emerald ash borer," referring to an invasive beetle from Asia that's been ravaging North American ash species for the last 2 decades. "As far as I've seen, this island hasn't been affected by the borer yet at all." This feels like good tidings, or at least like temporary relief in an era where each day seems to bear worse environmental news than the one before. Mature ash trees are particularly beautiful inhabitants of our forests, with branches that sweep elegantly away from their trunks and furrowed bark that looks like something out of a storybook. They are old inhabitants as well. Ashes have been growing in the southeastern United States for more than 30 million years. It will be a great pity if the North American varieties are all wiped out by this emerald ash borer, which is a very real possibility. For today, at least, they are alive and seemingly healthy on this remote swamp island. For some perspective on champion trees, I reached out to Gary Williamson, one of the most prominent big tree hunters in America. The 81-year-old and his friend, Brian Carmine, both of Virginia, have found hundreds of state and national champions in their 4 days of searching. In the latest National Register of Champion Trees, they are noted as the most prolific nominators in the country. Of the 548 trees on the national list, Williamson and Carmine tracked out 62 of them. A few years ago, Ferreira contacted Williamson online. He and Kane had started finding potential champions of their own and was eager to compare notes with the two experts north of the state line. A kind of intergenerational friendship ensued, one centered around giant trees. Williamson said, "We have a good national program at the University of Tennessee, and from what I understand, North Carolina's big tree program is rolling. It's in good shape with two hunters like Lucas and Spencer. These two are the future of the North Carolina big tree program." "But what about tree hunting itself?" I asked Williamson. "Do champion trees have any role to play in our lives, in forest management, for example, or conservation? Did they do anything other than just stand around being big?" He said, "They can play a big part, and I'll use the congaree as an example. The Congaree floodplain spans thousands of acres in Richland County, South Carolina. It's a special kind of ecosystem, an old-growth bottomland hardwood forest, one of the best preserved and largest remaining of its kind. Williams said when it was just Congaree Swamp, and under private ownership, they called it Congaree, Forest of Champions, because it had so many big, impressive champion trees. The landowners, however, were from a logging family, and they harvested timber from the property off and on from the 1880s through to the 1970s. The logging eventually threatened the last remnants of the old-growth forest, producing a public backlash and a popular movement for the federal government to buy the property and preserve it. Congress acquired the land and turned it into a national monument in 1976, then a national park in 2003. The number and sheer size of the championship trees in the area was central to that push for protection. Williams said it became a national park because these trees were so impressive, the Congaree was saved. Kane and Ferreira eventually locate this overcup oak right where they left it 2 years ago, a few hundred feet inland from Turkey Quarter Creek, next to a mucky slough. It's the perfect place for an overcup oak, a swamp-dwelling species that loves to cast shade over standing water with its lustrous, deeply lobed leaves. The tree is huge, especially around the trunk, but Ferreira, estimating the height at close to 100 feet, determines it's probably too short to challenge the 124-foot specimen in Martin County that currently holds the state title, even if its trunk circumference and crown spread turn out to be larger. At best, it might be named a co-champion, a designation given to trees that score within a few points of the current state or national champ, but aren't large enough to supplant it outright. However, Kane and Ferrer aren't interested in nominating co-champions. If they were, they would have nominated a half dozen other specimens they found, including a hackberry, an American bladdernut, a Washington hawthorn, and others that are big, but probably not big enough to become undisputed state champions. Still, Kane and Ferrer mark the coordinates of this overcup oak. Seasoned tree hunters keep running lists of their notable finds, even if they aren't yet clear contenders. No one knows which trees will keep growing and which will fall. Should the current champ die, it's good to have potential replacements at the ready and to know exactly where they are. I ask Ferreira and Kane if the trees we've seen today have any commercial value. Ferreira answers, yeah, a lot of these trees out here do. Laurel oaks, not so much, but the overcups do. And on a bit higher ground than this, cherry bark oaks, they're one of the most commercially valuable oaks. They grow fast, really tall and straight. This species awakens a memory in Kane. He says, we found a huge cherry bark oak on the north end of Jordan Lake near Durham. And right at the base of it was a bobcat and its babies. That was the first time I'd ever seen a bobcat. I've never run into a bobcat before, and I'm not sure I would want to in a forest wilderness, especially if it was with its babies. But Kane's story is a welcome reminder that commercial value isn't the only kind of value these trees hold. Oaks, in particular, nourish and shelter countless species. Back in the boat, cruising down a cut through the Neuse River, we pass a section of Turkey Quarter Island we haven't seen yet. Ferreira, one hand on the tiller of the outboard motor, lets his gaze run across the canopy overhanging the creek and sighs with disappointment. He points to a few sickly trees next to the bank, their outermost twigs and branches bare of leaves. He says, I was talking about how the emerald ash borer hadn't made it out here. I think it's made it now. Treatments exist for ash trees infested with the borer, but they're too expensive and impractical to be used in forest settings. Within 20 years, this section of the river likely won't have a single mature ash left alive, whether green, Carolina, or any other kind. Saplings might continue sprouting up here and there for a while, but no ash will ever live long enough to resemble anything close to a champion. on the flooded banks of the Neuse River, Ferreira and Kane have brought me to the last tree of the day, a very big deciduous holly. This one is so big, they're thinking of bypassing the state big tree list entirely and nominating it directly to the national list. Though when I say big, I mean big for a deciduous holly. These are normally smaller trees, and when we find the specimen partly submerged in floodwaters, I'm struck by the possibility of a champ that's so modest in size, at least relative to the others we've seen today. Ferreira points out, though, that the champion trees of smaller species are often the most impressive. They don't get the kind of attention that huge oaks and pines do. Most people walk or boat right by them, oblivious to their existence. But they have survived a very long time to get where they are. Ferreira say they grow pretty slow, especially being in the understory here. This one's probably about 100 years old. Due to the flooding, it's impossible to take exact metrics on the tree for a nomination, so they take some approximate measurements instead for a quick check on its chances of making the national list. Ferreira says, I think the national champ is, what, 80 points, Spencer? Oh, close, Kane confirms. 41-inch circumference, says Ferreira, inspecting, and then probably, oh, I read it at 30 feet tall, so that'd be 71 points right there. And that's not even including crown spread, which would add more points to its score. It's probably right around 80, he says, and it might be taller than 30 feet. Definitely the biggest deciduous holly I've ever found. The two determine it is worth coming back in drier conditions to get numbers for an official nomination. If a certified tree measurer from the National Register comes out and validates those numbers, it will easily replace the current national champion, which sits at 76. In other words, if this big holly on the Neuse River keeps doing what trees do, putting one ring on top of the other, it stands a good chance of becoming a champion someday. And if it can defy the forces arrayed against it, floods, storms, pests, and others surely to come, it might even remain champion, at least for a while. Well, folks, I'm glad to have been able to finish that story. I thought I would run out of time, but I haven't. But now I have. So John Feddersen will have to bid you adieu for this week's edition of Indie Week. It's available after our broadcast on Friday in the podcast section of ncreadingservice.org. So I would suggest that you go there and find past issues and of this and the many other publications that are available on our station. So for ncreadingservice.org, John Feddersen for the Indie Week, bidding you farewell, and we will be with you next week. Bye-bye.